I'd like to welcome you to the parasitic disease of the gastrointestinal tract surgical management session, panel session. On behalf of Dr. George Velmahos and myself, George Fass, we're going to talk today, focus mainly on hydatid echinococcal disease, and see how, get some input and advice from our medical and infectious disease colleagues regarding the basic ways to manage, talk a bit about surgical complications and management in the abdomen, extra-abdominal sites, in the thorax, and also get a lot of information about tips and tricks to use in the management by our speakers who are all experts in this disease. Without any further ado, I'd like to ask our first speaker, Dr. Rocia Hurtado. She's from an infectious disease physician and tropical medical specialist at the Tropical and Geographic Medicine Center in the Infectious Disease Division, the Massachusetts General Hospital. And she spends most of her time all around the world. So she will talk to us about what a surgeon needs to know regarding the diagnosis and management of hydatid disease.
I thank the organizers. It's a deep pleasure to be here. We have a very distinguished panel, and I suspect there's probably not too many infectious disease physicians in the audience. So my role today is to give a bit of a bird's eye view to contextualize some of the future presentations. I have no disclosures. A couple of definitions for the crowd. Echinococcosis is a zoonotic infection where humans are accidental hosts, caused by the larval stage of the cestode or dog tapeworm species belonging to the genus Echinococcus. There are two main forms of the disease. Cystic disease, also called hydatid disease, is caused in about 88% of times by E. granulosis, and about 12% of times by Equinus or Lepi and Canadensis. And polycystic disease, which is mainly restricted to Latin America and for which there are no more than 1,000 cases reported due to E. vogli and E. oligoarthritis. We will not be speaking today about alveolar echinococcal disease, which is a fascinating and important topic. This is due to the larval form of Echinococcus multilocularis, and you can see in the bottom panel, it appears and behaves very differently than traditional cystic disease. It behaves in an infiltrative manner and is much akin in many ways to a malignancy as well. So this will be the last you will hear from this. The epidemiology of Echinococcus is typically mimics that of the rural grazing areas of the world. There are many canids and intermediate hosts that live in close proximity, and it's hyperendemic in parts of the Middle East, Mediterranean countries, parts of South America, Northern Africa. There are a few foci even within our midst in the United States as outlined here. And I mentioned very briefly that multilocularis, which causes alveolar echinococcosis, is restricted to the northern hemisphere only. It's estimated that there are approximately 2 to 3 million people at least living with this disease, and in certain hyperendemic areas of the world, including as you see in the lower right panel, this is a picture from the Turkana region in East Africa and Kenya, it's estimated that dogs have a prevalence of the tapeworm as high as 60%. I always hesitate to show life cycles, but I will just briefly mention, because it's important to understand this disease in nature, what happens. So the definitive host where the adult parasite is allowed to grow, the tapeworm, are, for intents and purposes of this talk, we'll use the dog. So it's typically a canid. The dog with the tapeworm will excrete thousands of eggs, and these eggs are traditionally in nature consumed by the intermediate host. And so we'll use the sheep as the prototype. And then eventually, dogs will ingest the viscera, which have arrested development, and the larval forms, and this is traditionally by virtue of ingesting offal, and the cycle will continue in nature. So we are accidental hosts, and so the way that we acquire this infection is by ingesting the eggs. And many of us, of course, don't wake up and say, I'm going to eat echinococcal eggs today. But what typically happens is that these eggs get attached to the fur of the dogs, and children, which are high-risk individuals in terms of how intimately they play with animals, will then touch the dog and accidentally ingest eggs. The eggs can also lace the agricultural and water supply. And I show that there are some additional non-traditional ways of acquiring this infection, including in certain parts of East Africa, dog intestine is consumed, and in parts of the Middle East, dog feces are also used in the tanning industry. And so there are many ways that one can acquire this infection. I just want to remind everybody here that this is a very interesting infection, whereby there are actually three layers in the traditional hydatid cyst. The outer layer is termed the pericyst, and this is actually formed by fibroblasts and blood vessels from the actual host. This occurs in most forms of the disease with the exception of the bone. There's a middle laminated layer, which is termed the ectocyst, and this is an acellular layer, primarily made of hyaline. And then there's the endocyst, and this is the germinal layer where a lot of the asexual reproduction is occurring, and this is where you get your daughter cysts, your brood capsules. You can see the layering protoscolices, which give rise to the appearance in ultrasonography of hydatid sand. I'm going to briefly touch upon the clinical presentation. Up to 60% of patients are actually asymptomatic with this infection, and many of these patients are noted to ultimately have a lesion that tips off their physicians about hydatid disease as incidental findings. But when patients present clinically, they typically present in the context of either an immunologic and allergic phenomenon. The classic story is someone is hit during sports or contact on the flank, and they may develop anaphylaxis and shock, and or in the context of mechanical factors or complications. And this may result from either impingement, especially as the cysts grow, of vital structures, communication with cysts, the formation of fistula, and infections, abscesses, and other complications. The cysts traditionally in the liver grow 1 to 5 millimeter per year. The exception to this growth rate is in the thorax, where the negative intrathoracic pressure also facilitates growth, and growth rates up to 6 centimeter per year have actually been described in the literature. The average presentation is in adulthood, even though many patients acquire the infection in childhood. And laboratory findings really depend on the site of involvement. Oftentimes, they are not particularly localizing, and only 10 to 15% of patients will have underlying peripheral eosinophilia. So after the cysts are ingested, the oncosphere eventually enters into the circulation, and it is no surprise that the liver is the main organ affected. This is followed by the lung, and then 1% of time, any other areas. And so you can see in this pictorial distribution, ranging from lung involvement to liver involvement. In the middle panel, you can see the water lily sign. In the middle, you can see a kidney cyst with heavy infestation. To the right, obturator involvement, pelvic involvement, pleural disease, and even cerebral disease. So all parts of the body, in theory, can potentially be involved. Just a reminder, and this impacts how we manage and how we think about patients, that there are many complications that can occur in the context of hydatid disease. The three main categories include fistulization, so in the liver with the biliary tree. This can lead to bacterial abscesses, in the chest with the bronchial tree, and some characteristic clinical findings that will probably be reviewed as well. Secondary bacterial infection is actually quite important and important to manage. And then in the context of cyst rupture, patients may present with secondary dissemination or anaphylactic shock. The diagnosis across the vast majority of the world relies heavily on imaging, with ultrasound really being the working horse. There's an entire well-defined classification of these cysts that you can see here, and I don't pretend that you will actually be able to read all of these details. CT or MRI may be useful. They're obviously more costly. MRI has actually very good correlation with ultrasound. One of the downfalls of MRI, not downsides, is that it cannot pick up on calcification particularly well. But in patients in whom you might be suspecting the possibility of fistulization, an MRCP can often be helpful, and its sensitivity can be as high as 90%, and it is less morbid than an ERCP. immunodiagnostics, which are basically serology tests, there's some antigen tests, immunoblots, et cetera, are really meant to be ancillary and oftentimes may or may not be used depending on the clinical setting. They have varying sensitivities. They perform best in hepatic disease with sensitivities that can range in the mid-80s to mid-90s. Extrahepatic sites, the sensitivities tend to be lower. So, for instance, for pulmonary disease, we're talking 50 to 60%. They do have some issues with specificities, primarily related to cross-reaction with other helminthic infections. And then there are certain circumstances, if an aspiration is performed, if an ERCP is done, where you may actually be able to visualize hooklets and protoscolices if the cyst is aspirated. This is a very nice graphic that I love to show because it gives a pictorial sense as to size. And as you can see, as the cysts grow in size, the risk of complications also grow, and also the stage. And so for inactive cysts, such as C4, C5, these are typically the folks that we want to do surveillance on. For large cysts, these are the folks who typically we may be leaning a little bit more towards surgery. And then in the middle range, and with certain additional characteristics, some of the percutaneous techniques may be used. So to recap, the management really depends on the stage, the site of disease. So there are certain sites where surgery is favored. The extent of disease and size, in particular, can be important in certain sites, and whether complications are present. And oftentimes, the complications may shift a little bit more towards the surgical side, and depending on which of these there are. So I'm not going to spend any time talking about surgery or PAIR and additional modalities. I will briefly mention that antiparasitics can be used. The response in general, if you use antiparasitics exclusively, and most of this data is derived from the liver literature, is about 30%. There are, of course, certain patients, because they have inoperable disease, they may have a lot of comorbidities, they may have disseminated cysts, peritoneal cysts, in which you may be faced with this possibility. If the cysts are smaller in size, they typically perform a little bit better as well. The antiparasitic agents we typically use are albendazole or mebendazole. I chose to highlight albendazole here because it achieves higher concentrations than mebendazole, and it's typically considered first line. And for many years, we used to use these periodic schedules where we would have time off. But now there are studies that have shown that the continuous treatment with albendazole is actually better than the cyclical treatment, and therefore that's what we typically use. I will mention to the clinicians in the room that this class of drugs requires fat for absorption. It's contraindicated in pregnancy, and your patient should be monitored for hepatotoxicity, for bone marrow suppression, and for alopecia. And when you see the alopecia related to albendazole, it can be quite striking and very distressing to patients. In the context of peritoneal spillage, we oftentimes include the addition of praziquantel as well. So I mentioned there are some patients in whom exclusive medical therapy is used. And then the big question in the literature and amongst clinicians is, for those who will be accessing an intervention, namely primarily surgery, how long do you treat prior to surgery? And so there are various protocols that are out there in clinical practice that range from a day to a month of preoperative antiparasitics. And unfortunately, we don't have a randomized control trial to tell us which is preferred. I would say in clinical practice, typically in the 1 to 2 weeks is very common. And then obviously intraoperatively, postoperatively, most treatment ranges in the 1 to 6 month range, and it really depends on the site and whether there were intraoperative complications. There will be many panelists touching upon surgery, so I just mentioned it here. And then just a schematic about the PAIR procedure, and there are additional percutaneous and aspiration techniques as well. The one thing I will highlight about the PAIR procedure is, in particular, that you do not want to inject the protoscolicidal agent if there's any possibility of fistulization, and that is because you will give your patient sclerosing cholangitis if present in the liver, another sclerosing complication as well. And this is really not meant to be for very complex cysts. And so I will mention that. And ERCP, while not endorsed by the WHO in certain selected scenarios, may be useful as a diagnostic and management tool, but this does require additional study as well. And so I think my time is up, and it's been a true pleasure to be here with you today, and I look forward to hearing our other speakers. Thank you very much.